All right, we're going to get started. My name is Tony Shea. I'm the CEO of Zappos. Wanted to take a quick survey first. How many of you have actually purchased from Zappos before? Very cool. How many of you know that we sell clothing in addition to shoes? How many of you know that we want to build our brand to be about the very best customer service? And how many of you know about our focus on company culture? And how many of you heard that a year ago we announced we're moving into downtown Las Vegas, taking over City Hall and helping revitalize downtown Vegas? Cool. So that's what I just went through is how we think of our brand internally in terms of it used to be the three C's, now it's the four C's: clothing, customer service, company culture, and community. And about back in 2007, about 5 years ago, actually having nothing at all to do with Zappos, I started reading all these books and articles about the science of happiness, which I just thought was really interesting. And as I started reading more and more of these articles and books, I realized that a lot of the stuff that I was reading could actually be applied to business, because what we're trying to do is trying to make customers happy, trying to make employees happy, trying to make our vendors and business partners happy. And one of the first books that I came across was Chip Conley's book called Peak, P-E-A-K, and I actually talk about him in that book in the talks that I do, as well as the book that I wrote called Delivering Happiness. And so a lot of the stuff that we do at Zappos has actually been modified, especially on the company culture side, because of stuff that's in Chip Peak's, Chip Conley's book, Peak. And so for example, his book, generally, just to give you a rough idea, takes Maslow's hierarchy, which has seven levels or so, or five levels, and condenses it down to three levels, and then he applies that to customers and employees and investors. So for example, for employees, the three levels of how they think of their work are: do they think of their work as a job, career, or calling? And our whole goal at Zappos is to move employees up that pyramid, and a lot of our inspiration comes from Chip Conley. And so super excited that Chip has come out with a new book. We've been friends for several years. His new book, Emotional Equations, has actually hit the New York Times bestseller list, and want to give you guys more time with Chip. So, Chip Conley.
There's a little prize for some of you afterwards from Tony and his team at Delivering Happiness to celebrate their one-year anniversary, so I'll tell you about that at the end. It's great to be here. Thank you, Tony. Really appreciate it. I have had this weird fascination with the crossroads of psychology and business since I started my company 25 years ago. Most of us, when we think of the intersection of psychology and business, sort of think of a fender bender. I mean, the psychology, you know, it's a rather treacherous intersection, psychology and business. But what I'm going to present today, partly in personal story and then partly in understanding the psychology of your customer, is going to be hopefully an opportunity for me to be your crossing guard at the intersection of psychology and business. So we're going to start with a little video that will remind us about our emotional baggage. So here we go. Check it out.
Hello there. Checking any bags?
Yeah, just two.
Okay. The second bag will be $100.
Yeah. Okay, just one bag then.
Here's your boarding pass, sir. Gate 83. Enjoy your flight.
Bound to fall, bound to fall.
star of our show. So, the truth is, we all know we have emotional baggage. What we don't know is that we have emotional baggage within our emotional baggage. And what I'm going to talk about today is how to unpack your baggage, how to understand what's going on inside of us. We carry our emotions with us for a lifetime, but we know a lot more about how to work on our computer or drive a car. We're never taught our emotions. So my opportunity to be up here and talk about this in the context of customers will be the second half of my conversation with you. But the first half is I'm going to make it a little bit more personal, because sometimes South by Southwest gets very heady and it doesn't really sort of tell you some personal stories. And I'm just going to give you a quick personal story. First of all, I started my company, which is the second largest boutique hotel company in the U.S., Joie de Vivre, about 25 years ago when I was a small child. And so I know for 25 years that people have been checking in at our front desk with their physical baggage and their emotional baggage. We carry it with us. 10 years ago, I got particularly fascinated with this intersection of psychology and business. And that's when in the dot-com bust, we were based in San Francisco. We're the largest hotelier in the Bay Area. And at the worst of times, I got reacquainted with Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs pyramid. And then we remade it, as Tony said, for our company, not with any idea that there's going to be a book in this. And then ultimately, I went out and started studying Apple and Southwest Airlines and Whole Foods Markets and Harley Davidson, and I found out that all these great companies had used Apple. Yes, that's true. They had all used Maslow's hierarchy of needs in some way in how they had actually built their operating model. Well, that was the last downturn. We're 4 years into this downturn, and I have to say that in the last downturn, I felt a little bit like a gladiator, and the company we were primed to grow, and we tripled in size in the dot-com bust. This time, I felt more like a prisoner. I felt like a prisoner for all kinds of reasons. I won't go into my sad story, but I had a lot of things going wrong in my life, and I didn't want to be CEO anymore of this company, this beast of a company that was now 3,500 employees, and 2008 came around, and I could see, because the hotel industry, we see the recession before most industries because travel is a very discretionary expense. And I could see we were going into our second once-in-a-lifetime downturn in the same decade, and I didn't want to be doing this anymore. I didn't want to be CEO, but I didn't have a choice. I was the founder, and I couldn't walk away from the job. So I started reading a book by Viktor Frankl. How many have read Frankl before, Man's Search for Meaning? Probably the most profound book ever written on meaning. And I was reading this because I loved this quote, which I will read for you. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. And I needed that because I felt like I was a pinball, you know, in a pinball machine with my emotional reactivity to everything that was happening around me. It was, you know, just a lot of bad stuff happening. So I just realized, okay, if Viktor Frankl, who was in a concentration camp in World War II, can live through a concentration camp and figure out how to create a space between stimulus and response, I can too. Then, that's not me. I know it might look like me when I was in high school. It actually did. I used to have blonde hair like that too. I was a surfer. But that's my good friend Chip. Chip Hankins was my best friend named Chip in the world. We were going to create a chip party for all the chips in the world. He was our insurance broker for about 12 or 13 years. He was my mirror in life in many ways. We had a lot in common. And on April 30th, 2008, I was giving a speech on self-actualization, not feeling very self-actualized, in St. Louis, Missouri. And I got a call from Chip's boss telling me that he had just heard from Chip's wife that Chip had committed suicide. Chip had actually taken his own life. Chip was the first of six friends of mine who have actually taken their lives in this downturn. And I found out this news in St. Louis at a time when I was in the early stages of my own depression. So I sat down and over the next couple months, I really said to myself, how can I learn more about that man's search for meaning? How can I learn to create more space between stimulus and response, so I'm not so reactive, and I'm more responsive. And then I was in St. Louis again for another speech in August of 2008, just about 2 months, 3 months after Chip's memorial service. And it's weird to go to a memorial service for a friend who's taken their own life. That's hard. It's harder when they have the same name you have, and it's a strange name like Chip. And it's harder yet when you're going through a depression and you've had your own moments of thinking of the Golden Gate Bridge when you're there and people are getting up and telling their Chip stories. Well, in August of 2008, I had broken my leg, broken my ankle playing baseball. I had a bacterial infection in my leg because I had fertilizer in my leg that I didn't know about from the baseball field. My leg was swollen. I was on some bad antibiotics. Long story short is the end of a speech in St. Louis again, strangely enough. I don't go to St. Louis much anymore because I always have bad news there. At the end of the speech, I was up here standing. I was on crutches because I had a broken ankle. And I was thankfully sat down to sign some books. And I went flatline. I didn't go flatline immediately. I went unconscious. And within 5 to 7 minutes, I went flatline right as the paramedics arrived. And they put their heart monitors on me right when it all happened. In the next hour and a half, I died 5 times, flatlined 5 times, at 47 years old. Not a heart attack. They still don't even know what it was. I call it divine intervention. But what it taught me is that I needed to figure out that man's search for meaning and turn it into something that I could use on a daily basis. And so I turned it into an equation. Now, I am not a math guy. A lot of you in the room are. I am definitely not. But what the nice thing that's great about math is it's simple, concise, and to the point. And for those of you who don't like math in the room, you will be scared of these equations. Don't be scared. Math is about relationships. Usually it's the relationship of numbers. Today, in our time together, it's going to be the relationship of emotions. The equation that spoke to me about man's search for meaning that helped me to almost create this into a mantra was despair equals suffering minus meaning. Suffering is the constant. For Viktor Frankl in a concentration camp, yes, suffering is a constant. If you're in a recession and you're a CEO of a company you don't want to be running anymore and you're not, you know, you're running out of cash, you have a long-term relationship ending, you have a son going to San Quentin prison wrongfully, yes, suffering is ever present. If you don't have a job, it's ever present. If you have a bad job, it's ever present. If you have a bad marriage, it's ever present. If you don't have a marriage, it's ever present. Suffering is a constant, number one, first noble truth of Buddhism. Meaning, on the other hand, is a variable. So if suffering is a constant and meaning is a variable in this sacred algebra, increase the meaning, and what happens to despair? Goes down. For those of you who don't do math in the room very much, think of 3 equals 10 minus 7. 7 goes to 8, 3 goes to 2. So the question I asked myself on a daily basis in the fall of 2008, we were launching our 15th new hotel in a 21-month period at the worst of times, and I would just on a daily basis, maybe on an hourly basis, recite this to myself. Then November of 2008, when we were really going through a difficult time, and we were doing our budgets for 2009, and who could predict what 2009 was going to look like at that point, especially in the travel business where we have huge ups and downs. I was standing in front of 80 of our top executives and general managers of the hotels, and I was supposed to give a cheerleading speech about 2009 being rah, rah, it's going to be a great year. And all I saw in the room was suffering. And instead, I threw away my speech, and I just got to the easel, and I said, for the next hour, we're going to do something that Abe Maslow called psychohygiene. Abraham Maslow created the phrase psychohygiene, and what he basically meant by that is that great organizations create great psychohygiene. When you're going through difficult times, your company can be a sweatbox. You have to learn how to actually figuratively, not literally, take a shower together as an organization. And what we did is we spent an hour taking a shower together, and I told them why this equation meant a lot to me, what we could do with it. What we could do with it is to ask ourselves, what's the lesson? What's the meaning? What are we supposed to learn here? There's a fascinating study from 20 years ago where scientists, social scientists, studied women who became widows later in life. They had two control groups. One was women who actually had gone through the depression in their teens and 20s, and the other control group was women who had not. What they found is that women who had actually gone through the depression during their formative years were much better able to handle being a widow later in life because they learned the emotional muscles of courage, resilience, and independence at a difficult time earlier in their life. So I started to ask myself, what are the emotional muscles that I'm learning during this emotional boot camp? And I asked our senior team, the top 80 people, to do the same. Well, at the end of the 1 hour talk, a lot of tears, a lot of, you know, there was a lot of catharsis in the room. Someone came up to me and they whispered, "Chip, do you have an equation for jealousy?" And then someone else said, "Do you have one for anxiety?" And someone else asked me about happiness. So I just decided, well, if I want to learn more about emotions. So at the time that I was trying to figure out how to take the company to a place where we were in a safer place, I also spent the next 2 years in the rooms and meeting spaces and sometimes in the homes and second homes of some of the luminaries in the psychology profession, from Mahali Csikszentmihalyi to Barry Schwartz to Dan Goleman. And I learned everything I could about emotions. And what I didn't know 2 or 3 years ago was that there's a lot of similarities between our emotions and colors. Now, you probably didn't know that. How many of you knew that Isaac Newton created the color wheel? Well, there's about 2 or 3 of you. So he did. And we know that if red plus blue, you add red and blue, you get purple. What I didn't know is there's this guy named Dr. Robert Plutchik, who 30 years ago, when the study of emotions was actually not very well-respected within the psychology profession, he created an emotion wheel. And the idea that you could actually combine one emotion with another and get a third, here you can see if you combine joy plus anticipation, you get optimism. So I started to realize, wow, this idea of combining emotions, creating a recipe or ingredients for emotions is relevant and has some historical basis. So I decided the second emotion that I would focus on after doing despair equals suffering minus meaning was happiness. Why not? I mean, I did despair, so why not try happiness? And of course, the place I went to learn about happiness, I could have gone to Zappos. That would have been a good place to go learn about happiness, and I've gone to Zappos. If you haven't done the tour at Zappos, go. Now you need to go do the tour of Zappos and the tour of downtown, which I got to do last weekend with Tony and Jen and the team in Vegas and had a great time. So I instead went to Bhutan. And the reason I went there is because 40 years ago, the king of Bhutan uttered the weirdest phrase. He said, when he was in India and a journalist asked him, you know, what's your, it was GNP then, what's your gross national product? And he looked at the journalist, he said, "I don't really care about our gross national product, I care about our gross national happiness." So for 40 years now, Bhutan has been the country that actually has been sort of on the forefront of trying to actually create metrics for an intangible, which is happiness. Now, for those of you who don't know Bhutan, it's between China and India. This is Tiger's Nest there, pretty special place. Shangri-La, that's how people describe Bhutan. I came back with an equation. I was fortunate enough to go present it at the TED conference 2 years ago. And this is it, happiness. It's about happiness equals wanting what you have divided by having what you want. Now, let me explain that to you. Wanting what you have is really obvious. That means we appreciate things. We practice gratitude, for example. The act of wanting what you have is to practice gratitude. The denominator here is a place where many of us spend our time, especially those of us who are very type A and aggressive and we go off and, you know, pursue our life. The truth is, the bottom of this equation, when you're having what you want, the act of going out and trying to have what it is that you want is going out and trying to pursue something. Now, there's nothing wrong with pursuit. In fact, in the context of happiness, it's in our Declaration of Independence. But if you look in some dictionaries at the definition of pursuit, you will see the definition, to chase with hostility. Do we chase happiness with hostility in this country? I think we do at the mall at Christmas time. So the question that I started asking myself that helped me to understand this happiness equation, how to unlock it, was, do I spend a little bit too much time in the denominator? Am I bottom heavy? And when I am, how am I going out and practicing gratitude? And just to go out and feel the gratitude without actually giving it to someone or, you know, sharing it is like, you know, wrapping a holiday present and not giving it to anybody. So fastest way to get to gratitude is to practice, fastest way to get to happiness is to practice gratitude. I'm going to give you one more equation that you can use in your own life. Oh, but I'm actually going to first quote Socrates because a speaker who quotes Socrates, Socrates sounds smart up here, right? So over 2,000 years ago, Socrates said something that was particularly relevant to this equation. He said, "He who is not contented with what he has would not be contented with what he would like to have." Damn, that's the equation. Wanting what you have, divided by having what you want. You didn't know that Socrates was the first guy to go on a treadmill, right? Or that he had Nikes way before any of the rest of us. But basically what he was talking about is the hedonic treadmill. And that's what happens when you're hanging out in the bottom of the equation. You're on that treadmill, and we all know we've been on it, the hedonic treadmill, where whatever it is that we want, once we get it, we want twice as much, or twice as, you know, twice as beautiful, twice as skinny, twice as whatever. And that's what happens. And it's, you know, it's nothing bad. It sort of like helps us to make the better world a better place, but it also can actually make us unhappy. Okay, last equation before I actually take this to our customers. And this is anxiety. The number one emotion in most organizations in the United States right now is anxiety. It's three times the second place emotion in terms of what emotion is the relevant emotion in the petri dish of our organizations. There are two ingredients of anxiety. Now, I don't just go out and create this parlor game and just come up with this stuff. I go out and talk to the experts, and they told me two things. It's the thing that makes us anxious is what we don't know and what we can't control. So the equation, and it's not a plus sign, it's a time sign because it's combustible when you combine them. So it's uncertainty times powerlessness. So for those of you who want to say, well, what do I do with that? I mean, great, Chip, that's just an equation. Here's how you can make it real in your life. So anxiety, you create an anxiety balance sheet, and there's four columns. What do I know about this thing that's making me anxious? What don't I know? It's column two. Column three is what can I influence? And column four is what can't I influence? Here's the weird thing. Do this, spend 20 minutes about something that you're anxious about, and guess what? 75% of us in this room would find the following result. We would find that we have more things under items one and three, the assets, than we do under columns two and four. Why do I know that? Because we've done this in over two dozen companies already. And that's the results pretty consistently. So what happens when we get anxious is we tend to get very fixated with columns two and four. And we forget about what's in column one and three. And we also look at column two and say, well, I don't know. Let's say the thing you're anxious about is you're going to get laid off. You're worried that there's going to be layoffs in the company, and you're worried that your job is in jeopardy. Okay, relevant. That's a relevant thing to provide anxiety. So what do you learn here? Well, what don't I know? I don't know if there's going to be layoffs. Who does know? Well, maybe my boss knows. Well, I'm not going to go ask my boss if I'm going to get laid off. That's crazy. But there's a funny study, or not a funny study, it's an interesting and insightful study that's relevant here and relevant to us in the room who are leaders. They did a study a few years ago, and they gave people the opportunity to have two choices of getting an electric shock. There were no other choices. There wasn't a third choice of, like, none. So you could either get the electric shock now that's twice as painful as the electric shock you could get in the next 24 hours, or you could get the electric shock sometime randomly in the next 24 hours, and it would be half as painful. How many of you in the room would choose the more painful shock now? Yeah, raise your hand. Okay. How many of you would choose the half as painful shock, but randomly in the next 24 hours? Okay, probably about maybe 60-40. Well, two-thirds, one-third. Most of us, the majority of us, would choose to actually get the shock over with, even though it's twice as painful, because in some ways, psychological pain is worse than physical pain. So how's that relevant to us as leaders? If you have bad news to give, give it. Because if you don't give it, anxiety in the petri dish of your organization just becomes contagious and it gets worse. Okay, we're going to keep going. Because you wanted to hear about customers, so I'm now going to talk about customers. We're going to talk about the psychology of customers. I'm going to start with a quote, which I can't read with my old eyes. For some people, consumption, in its widest sense, has replaced religious belief as their main source of solace and comfort. Their main choices are dictated by a need to satisfy an inner hunger. I'm fascinated with our relationship, by the psychology of our relationship with our customers, because there's an inner need and hunger that is true of all of us, and especially in the modern era. Now, what's fascinating about customers is the fact that consumers' buying behavior is driven more by unconscious or unrecognized thoughts, because 95% of thoughts, emotions, and learning happen without our conscious awareness. I don't know how many of you saw the article, I think 3 weeks ago, in the New York Times Magazine about habits and buying habits of customers. And what they were able to show is that basically we're habitual in how we make our decisions. 50% of the decisions we make on a daily basis are related to habits we have. So trying to understand our relationship with our customers has a lot to do with understanding the psychology of customers and how do customers think and feel. So I'm going to start with a really simple equation. Disappointment equals expectations minus reality. Now, this is true in life, but it's certainly true of our relationship with our customers. So I've always had this phrase where I like to say disappointment is the natural result of badly managed expectations. I usually say that to our operations and our marketing department to make sure our marketing department is not getting too good and our operations department is not getting too bad. Because, you know, you can do a great job of marketing something, but if you can't actually deliver on it, you create disappointment. Disappointment's here. Reality is here. The difference is disappointment. I'm sorry, expectations is here. Expectations here. Reality is here. The difference is disappointment. So what do we learn? What can we know about human behavior that's relevant here? Well, as Tony mentioned earlier, I'm a Maslow fanatic. And to take Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the five-level version, and to turn it into three levels, that's what I did for my company, Joie de Vivre, and then that's what I wrote about in Peak. This is the three levels: survival, succeed, transform. This is a paradigm for life. This is what I call the transformation pyramid. Because basically the base of the pyramid, survival, is your physiological and safety needs, the first two levels of Maslow's pyramid. The succeed needs are your social belonging and your esteem needs, which are levels 3 and 4 of Maslow. And transformation is what it feels like when you're self-actualized. So survive, succeed, transform. Paradigm for life, we used this and applied it toward our employees, our customers, and our investors. What I'll show you now is the model for the customer pyramid. This is the customer pyramid. And again, for some of you thinking, this is way too fast, Chip, and that's why we have books. So there are books at the bookstore, and I'm actually going to be signing books after the session today. Meeting expectations. That's the survival need for your customer. And that's, you know, going back to the equation of disappointment equals expectations minus reality. Okay, if you haven't actually met expectations for your customer, you haven't even gotten on this pyramid. Because the base of the pyramid is just meeting the expectations. Now, what we all know in today's promiscuous era of the consumer, because the consumer has many more choices than they used to have because it's all on the internet, is that if you just satisfy the customer at the base of the pyramid, they're not necessarily going to be loyal. Meeting desires is a step above that, creates a successful relationship. But what I'm fascinated by is the top of this pyramid, the peak of the pyramid. How do we address the unrecognized needs of our customers? And that's what transformational companies really focus on. They're amazing at being able to look at the top of the pyramid and say, I understand my customer well enough so I can actually mind read what it is that they want, even though they don't know it themselves. So how do you do that? So let me describe that for a moment. Well, let me also go back for a second. Yeah. Oh, the gratuitous toilet shot. I'll come back to it. What's interesting about what is an unrecognized need today is that over time, it becomes an expectation. Think of the fax machine 25 years ago. I remember the first time I saw a fax machine, and I saw the paper go in it, and then I was talking on the phone with the person at the other end of the line, and I was like, oh my God, this is magic. How did this happen? How many of you use your fax machine today? So what happens with things in life is what's at the top of the pyramid has gravity. And gravity takes it down to the bottom of the pyramid and sometimes even off the pyramid. This is something that's off the pyramid. I remember 40 years ago, my parents would take us on our little summer vacation with our AAA guide, the tour book, and we'd go and stay in motels across the U.S. and Southwest, and we'd get to the motel, and the first thing my mom would look at is she'd go in the bathroom to see if they had actually cleaned the toilet. So for her, for my mom, this was in some ways in the early days of moteliers, and I started as a motelier and became a hotelier. But in the early days of hotels and motels, what we wanted was safety and, you know, we wanted the base of the pyramid kind of stuff. And actually just wrapping the toilet so it says sparkling clean told you that someone had cleaned the toilet. If you, in your hotel or motel today, and some of you are staying 75 miles away probably, if you went into your hotel or motel today and you saw this, this would be a turnoff, right? For most of us, at least. You sort of assume that people have actually cleaned the toilet. So the bottom line is, our needs as customers are extremely important, and they actually ratchet up over time. Our expectations ratchet up over time. And that's why the pyramid is particularly important, to understanding the unrecognized needs at the top of the pyramid. I'll just tell you how we did it in Joie de Vivre, my company. For 25 years now, I'm really proud. There is no hotelier in the world who has created more boutique hotels in the world than I have. And I'm really proud of that. I'm not saying it to be boastful. It's just true. I've over 50 boutique hotels in 25 years, including helping with the Hotel San Jose here in Austin, which my buddy Liz Lambert created about 15, 16 years ago when she saw my first hotel, the Phoenix, which is this funky rock and roll hotel in the Tenderloin. So every time we create a hotel, it's based upon a magazine. Why? Because magazine publishing and boutique hotels have something in common. They're very niche-oriented, and they're very lifestyle-oriented. So that first hotel, the Phoenix, we knew we were going to go after rock and rollers, because who else is going to stay in a 1950s motel in the ghetto? So we went after rock and rollers by creating a touchstone for the personality of the hotel, which was Rolling Stone. We came up with five adjectives that defined Rolling Stone, which were funky, irreverent, adventurous, cool, and young at heart. And everything we did in creating that hotel had to come back to those five adjectives. The magic, though, was this. I didn't know it at the time, but I started to see it when Dr. Timothy Leary checked into the hotel. Some of you know who he is, a famous hippie. He didn't fit the demographic of the Phoenix. The Phoenix demographic was 25-year-old male musicians from L.A. with tattoos. He fit the psychographic of the Phoenix. The psychographic of the Phoenix was the five adjectives: funky, irreverent, adventurous, cool, and young at heart. Dr. Timothy Leary, in his 70s before he died, loved the Phoenix because it provided what I will call an identity refreshment. He had his unrecognized need was by staying in the hotel, I'm staying in a habitat that feels like it's a mirror for my aspirations of how I see myself. No one talks that way other than psychologists, but that's what he was looking for. And that's why he kept coming back. And that's why he kept talking about it. And if you know he lived in a tweeting era, that's why he would tweet about it. And John Clammer says, shopping is not merely the acquisition of things, it is the buying of identity. More and more that's true. We buy our identity, and that's an unrecognized need at the top of the pyramid. So, you know, we couldn't just do rock and roll hotels, so we created other hotels. The New Yorker is the, you know, the Rex, and the five adjectives for that hotel are clever, literate, artistic, worldly, and sophisticated. In Union Square area. The Hotel Vitale, some of you may be familiar with in San Francisco, was two magazines, Dwell meets Real Simple, modern, urbane, fresh, natural, and nurturing. So what we found over time was that this model worked. So let me summarize how do you create a self-actualized customer, or how do you actually help customers to feel self-actualized in the process of using your product or service? I think there's four ways, and for those who want to dive deeper into this is in Chapter 9 of Peak, and I think they have books here, so you can learn more about it in Chapter 9. So first of all, help your customers meet their highest goals. That's the simplest, the most boring. If any of you are familiar with Bank of America, they created the most famous and successful savings program of all time by creating an electric piggy bank called Keep the Change. How many of you do Keep the Change out there? A handful of you. They just found that, long story short, is they had ethnographers hanging out with women who had kids, so basically single mothers, and found that these women, when they're actually filling in the checkbook, you know, in their check register, when they wrote a check for $28.28, they would actually, in the check register, write $29, because it was simpler to actually add later. And they said, so Bank of America said, okay, well, why don't we take that 72 cents, well, Bank of America today would just take that 72 cents and put it in their pocket, probably. But they said, why don't we just take that 72 cents and put it in a savings account for you? So when you get your bill will say $29. You paid $28.28, but your bill will say $29, and the 72 cents will go in a savings account, so we create an electric piggy bank for you so you can actually save. most successful saving program in the history of American banking. Oops, I want to go back to that. Secondly, give your customers the ability to truly express themselves. I mean, that's what we do with our identity refreshment with our different hotels, with Shirat Aviv. Harley-Davidson, I mean, how many companies in the world have 40,000 customers who go out there and tattoo the logo of the company on their body? I mean, that you know that you've actually helping your customer express themselves when they're doing that. Thirdly, make your customers feel like they're part of a bigger cause. Patagonia has done that since 1985, giving 1% of their revenues to environmental causes. And finally, offer your customers something of real value that they hadn't even imagined, whether it's the fax machine or Fred Smith who created FedEx. Generally speaking, transformational companies do one or more of these themes in how they actually connect with their customer. Let's move on to the second equation. I have just this one and then a third one, and then I'll sum up, do some Q&A. So the second equation, so disappointment has been around since the start of time. We are little disappointment machines. The caveman who went outside and found out it was raining and he couldn't go and find his brontosaurus burger. we've been disappointed for a long time. On the other hand, there's another emotion called regret. And regret is more of a modern emotion, more of a first world emotion, partly because it has a lot to do with choice. As we have more options in life, we have this tendency as humans to think that the more options we have, the better we can control the outcome. Lots of psychological research has shown that. So the more options we have, the more potential we can affect the outcome based upon our decisions, and the more potential for regret we have. So let me give you a little question. Here's an exercise. I'm going to give you one of two choices again. This is not about an electric shock. So you have two choices. I'm going to flip a coin. I can either give you $100 now, or I can give you $0 or $200 based upon your correct choice on whether it's heads or tails. So two choices. $100 now, you get it. It's done. It's yours. Or zero versus $200 based upon whether you picked the right head of the coin. How many of you would choose the $100 now? How many of you would choose the second alternative, the zero versus 200? Okay, the vast majority of you said the first. And you're an entrepreneurial crowd, so you're more risk-taking than most people. Most people, it's 2-1. We have, Daniel Kahneman has shown we have a 2-1 predilection for loss aversion. We don't want to have our loss. We don't want to actually have anticipated regret. So when I give you the option of $100 now or 200 versus zero, if I get the zero, not only do I get the zero, but I also get some regret. Now, if I give you the option of saying, okay, for you who chose the $100, you can choose your $100, but then I'm going to actually ask you still to name heads or tails, and you'll see whether you would have gotten a zero or 200. It all changes. It all changes. Now, here's the challenge in modern society, is we live in an era where we have a lot of choice. And Barry Schwartz has written a lot about this in The Paradox of Choice. The greater the choice, the more regret we have. Today, we have 50,000 items, 50,000 different kinds of items and varieties in a normal supermarket. We had 10,000 in 1975. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Russian dissident from the 1970s, said, America is full of choices. Unfortunately, all of them are mundane. I like that. What we've learned over time is that we've created almost too many choices for people. And by creating more choices, we create the possibility of more regret. Procter & Gamble, not long ago, chose to actually take their Head & Shoulders product, their shampoo, from 26 varieties to 15. And their sales went up by 10% as a result of making that change. So we have a tendency to think that more choice is better, and yet more choice leads to more regret. So let me tell you about Sheena Iyengar. Sheena Iyengar wrote a book called The Art of Choosing, and you probably heard the story of her. She set up in Menlo Park, California, two tables with jams. There was one table with 24 different choices of jams that people could taste and then buy. And then there was another table with just 6 choices of jams that people could then buy. 50% more people went to the table with 24 choices. 50% more people went to that choice. 24 choices. Yeah, you know, the shiny objects, more shiny objects. 10 times more people bought jams over here when there are only 6 choices. Interesting. So how we actually serve up choice for people has a lot to do with whether they're actually going to buy or not. Audi. Sheena A. Younger worked with Audi. When you buy an Audi, you have many, many choices of different kinds of options. In fact, you have 144 choices of options in 8 different categories. You have 56 interior colors. You have 26 exterior colors. You have 4 gear shift choices. So Sheena said, okay, I want to learn something here. How we architect choices for people has a lot to do with how they feel afterwards. So she had 2 choices. One is the choice of starting with the process of making a decision. The first choice you'd have of the 8 categories was a category that had 56 choices, like the interior colored choice. And then as you went through the 8 different choices you had, she would get to smaller and smaller choices. So the last choice you had was the choice about the gear shift style, which had only 4 choices. So that was one group. The second group, she did exactly the opposite. She said, let's start with just 4 choices, the gear shift, and then let's work up. Fascinating result. The people who actually did the second way, start with less choices and then grow to more choices, were dramatically happier with their choices. They spent much less time laboring through the process, and they spent a lot less money on options. So how we create choice for people has a lot to do with dealing with all of the choices. So Joie de Vivre, my company, gets bigger and bigger. We start with just a few hotels, and each one's a different magazine. Over time, we created a mess because we had too many choices, and each one's a different magazine and different personality. And like, I don't know which one's happening. And then in 2002 and 2001, after 9/11, all of you people started going to Expedia to buy your hotels. And it was a very commoditized approach, but long story short, it's where we all went. So instead, we decided to create a character. Her name's Yvette. Yvette the Hotel Matchmaker. And we created what I call Choice Architects. We created a 1-minute test, 5 questions. This is one of the 5 questions that is in the test on the Hotel Matchmaker site. It's jdvhotels.com. You take this, and this is 10 years old stuff, so it's not really fascinating technology, but it is fascinating in terms of what the result was, is people take a 1-minute test, and they learn which is the hotel, or which are the 5 hotels of our 35 that best fit their personality. Yvette is, in essence, giving you a psychographic fit. What we found is people were much more likely to actually buy when we did this than if they just went on their own process of looking through 35 hotels. Secondly, they were happier with their choice. Customer satisfaction ratings were 12 points higher for people who actually took this approach as opposed to those who came from Expedia. And at the end of the day, what we found with some was that they could actually blame Yvette if they ended up in the wrong hotel, Yvette, the hotel matchmaker. So they actually sort of felt a little bit less of the responsibility. So regret equals disappointment plus a sense of responsibility. How you create choice architecture around how people make decisions has a lot to do with how they feel about their decision making. Last equation before I sum up is one that, I always want to sneak in an Oscar Wilde quote because he was a pretty quotable guy, and he said, "Be yourself, everyone else is taken." Love that quote. It's true of us as individuals, it's also true of us as companies. Be yourself as a company. Everyone else is taken. So authenticity, working with the specialists in the world, the psychologists in the world who sort of deal with this, it's like 2 primary equations, 2 primary ingredients, self-awareness times courage. And here's a guy, before I show this guy, let me just say, one of the most favorite ways for people to make their company look like an authentic company is to name it after the founder. You know, Tom's. There's 2 different Toms here. There's Eileen Fisher. There's Burt's Bees. I couldn't call my hotel company Chips Hotels because I'm in Silicon Valley. And that just sounded weird, Chips Hotels. But the fact is most of us can't name our company after ourselves. So we have to actually look at other ways to actually understand what is it that creates that sense of authenticity with our customer. Now, this is a guy who has actually been talking about authenticity for many years, Howard Schultz. And he said in 1999, authenticity is what we stand for. It's part of who we are. If we compromise who we are to achieve higher profits, what have we accomplished? Eventually, all our customers would figure it out. Now, this is him 8 years later, looking a little older and sadder. And in 2007, when they were in trouble, he said, "Our outlets now reflect a chain of stores versus the warm feeling of a neighborhood store. Decisions have led to the watering down of the Starbucks experience and what some might call the commoditization of the brand." So, you know, he learned his lesson. Starbucks did, and as well. I'm good friends with Eric Ryan. I don't know if any of you have ever used Methods products. Great company based in San Francisco. Yeah, yeah. So Eric and I, you know, Eric has a history in branding, and before he started this, co-founded this company. And we had had some great conversations about the psychology of the customer. And this is something that Eric said that speaks absolutely to this idea of authenticity. He says, creating an authentic brand is about awakening your psyche and your customers. Being authentic is being self-aware and courageous. This is just as true for the entrepreneur as it is for their core customer. Underdog brands have such an opportunity to tap into that customer authenticity by helping the customer understand themselves better in the context of using the product and helping the customer feel courageous as if they've joined a movement. So one of the things that Eric says about joining the movement is that we need to have a core belief and vision that people can join in. People need to understand what that core belief is and the vision. And for Method, you know, their core belief is that cleaning should be clean. The cleaning should not necessarily pollute the environment in the process of cleaning something, which is historically what a lot of cleaning products are. They're like full of bad products. He also thinks that cleaning should make you happy. And that's why the products that Method creates have a design that has a very simple but happy kind of design. So what's to be learned here? Three questions we have asked ourselves within Joie de Vivre for 25 years now are the following three. The first one I actually learned from Theodore Levitt, a professor at Harvard Business School. He said, when in doubt, ask yourself the question, what business are we in? And then ask it 5 times. So do this exercise back in the office with some of your senior people. Have 2 people sitting right next to each other, and have one ask the other, what business are we in? If someone was here with me right now, I'd say, we're in the hotel business. We're in the lodging business. We take care of people who are traveling far away from home. Then that person will ask me the second question, same question again, what business are we in? And then you'll sort of go deeper. And then you'll go deeper a third time and a fourth time. When we got to our deeper the fifth time, I realized we were in the identity refreshment business. We're in the business of refreshing the identities of our customers. But you can do that as well. That helps you get the self-awareness that's part of this equation. What courageous, rebellious decisions have we recently made that could be perceived as brilliant or foolish? This is the courageous part of this equation. We created years and years ago an oxymoronic business, a luxury campground. It was a great idea. It failed. But I learned a lot in the process. And I think as a company, we became courageous. And I think to our customers, that we learned a lot about how we could actually take that experience and apply it to our boutique hotels later. Finally, what would it mean to the world if we didn't exist anymore? Now, for 24 years, I was the CEO of a company. I sold a majority interest of my company, Joie de Vivre, to John Pritzker, whose father started Hyatt. So now I spend most of my time writing, speaking, and consulting. And sometimes I'm consulting for big companies. And I love going into big companies and asking this question and seeing people flee for the hills. What would it mean to the world if we didn't exist anymore? What's our relevance? And it's a very important question in terms of understanding authenticity. All right. This is the 6 different equations we've looked at today. Despair equals suffering minus meaning. Happiness equals wanting what you have divided by having what you want. Anxiety equals uncertainty times powerlessness. Disappointment equals expectations minus reality. Regret equals disappointment plus a sense of responsibility. And authenticity equals self-awareness times courage. Why in the hell is this relevant to you? Well, for 24 years, I was a CEO. And my job was to execute. Execute people. No. Execute business plans. And I thought that, you know, that what I was supposed to do is just be an executive. And what I've learned over time after 24 years is that the best CEOs, and I mean CEOs in the broadest sense of the world, not everybody's a CEO in chief executive officer, but we are all CEOs of our lives, and you may be the CEO of your department. If you have kids and a marriage or other kind of relationship, you may be the CEO of that relationship and the family. We're all chief emotions officers. I'm sorry, that sounds glib. But once you understand, there are three key facts that really mean a lot as to why it's important to understand our emotions, not just for our own life, but in our role as leaders. Number one is 16 years ago, Dan Goleman, a guy who's been very supportive of me in writing this new book, Emotional Equations. He wrote a book called Emotional Intelligence, and he showed that 2/3 of the success of business leaders has to do with their EQ, and only 1/3 has to do with their IQ or the level of experience they have in their work. Secondly, emotions are as contagious as the flu. You know it when it comes to anxiety in the petri dish of an organization. You want to learn more about the contagious nature of emotions, read Nicholas Christakis' book called Connected. Great book. If I go and put someone in the front row and I start smiling at you, you'll smile back. We have mirror neurons in our brain. We also have socialization process. So understanding that emotions are contagious is extremely important for us to understand what's the emotional habitat we're creating, both where we work and for our customers. And finally, that is not me. That is Margaret Mead. Great business leaders are cultural anthropologists. They understand their customers better than the customers understand themselves. Unfortunately, as most businesses grow, their leaders become slaves to the process of business and lose that intuitive, emotional awareness of their customer. The most neglected fact in business is that we're all human. And we all have emotions. We all have emotional baggage. The question I'll ask you is, how do you open your emotional baggage? First of all, how do you even know it? You have it. But once you open it, what do you do with it? For me, figuring out how to create ingredients, understanding the recipe, it's like I'm bad in the kitchen, but if you give me a recipe, I might be able to make it work. If I can understand the recipe of my emotions, I can understand how to influence those emotions, and not just for myself, but maybe for people around me too. So I'm going to do one last thing and then open up for Q&A. Inside your emotional baggage, sometimes you have gifts. I have some t-shirts here. Here's one. Curiosity equals wonder plus awe. Okay, who wants it? Where you go? Oh, it's like, okay, here's, joy equals love minus fear. There you go. All right. And here's one we saw earlier. Despair equals suffering minus meaning. It's like Peyton Manning these days. Oh, my God. And then authenticity. Sorry. I went to Stanford, so I know Andrew Luck's going there. Authenticity equals self-awareness times courage. There you go. Oh, that was... Okay, last thought. First of all, for those of you who are staying till the end, the Q&A, Jen Lim and Tony Hsieh have a couple hundred comic books that just are right off the presses of Delivering Happiness, like the comic book version, which will be out there and not given to people leaving early. Just, you have to wait till the end. That's number one. Number two is, I want to say thank you to the folks at Prezi who helped me with my presentation. Thank you, guys. So that's a different kind of presentation than a normal sort of PowerPoint. And thanks to Moondog Pictures, who actually did the video. Back to Delivering Happiness. They're doing, I think there's some contest where the big winner of the contest gets to go to Las Vegas and to see what Zappos and Tony is doing in downtown Vegas. So that's in one of the comic books, I think. With that, I'm now going to open it up for questions. Thank you very much. Yes.
Thank you so much for that brilliant presentation. It was really good. My question is, in your customer pyramid, you talked about the base, and the base had meeting expectations.
Yes.
But you also talked about how the top of the base is coming down quickly, right, as time goes by.
It can come down over time, yes.
Right. So do you think it would be a good strategy when you're building a product or a company to target the unrecognized need?
Yes.
Or do you think you have to go from the base?
No. So if I put it in the format of a hotel, if you're staying in a hotel and your plumbing at 3 o'clock in the morning every night is banging against the wall, you didn't get the expectations right, the base of the pyramid. But just because you have great plumbing, it's what Hertzberg would call a hygiene factor. It's not the reason why you're going to go tweet about it or come back or be loyal. So aspire for the top of the pyramid. Aspire for the unrecognized needs. If you only aspire to create expectations today are disappointment tomorrow. Expectations today are disappointment tomorrow. Because over time, we get used to things, and then we actually, our expectation gets to a place where we go, we want something more than that. So start with the top of the pyramid. Yes.
Thanks, Chip. EJ, carry on with the Student Success Academy. I guess the question is, the customer, what if the customer in the equation, but you're really serving the consumer, so our kids, does the equation change when the customer is no longer the consumer?
It depends on how you're defining customer versus consumer. So if you're talking about the consumer being the actual person using your product, and then you have someone who's in the middle, in a B2B sense.
Yes. Well, yeah, the problem is understanding what the parents want, but then also understanding what the students want.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As a consumer. So I was just wondering, as a consumer as well,
yeah,
who maybe not be paying for it and has these expectations, is the consumer equation different?
What we've seen there, I will go back to my peak model with the pyramid, is that there, especially in a B2B context, you have two customers, pyramids. You have the customer pyramid for the person who's actually ultimately going to use the product, and then quite often you have someone else. Or let's say you're selling a product to banks. So you have the bank's customer pyramid, and then you have the decision maker's customer pyramid. And you need to take both into account. And you need to think about what's the unrecognized need for the decision maker, and what's the unrecognized need for the company overall. In the context of parents and children, what's the unrecognized need for the parent, and then what's the unrecognized need for the child?
Great.
One more question, and then we're done. There's somebody over here. Over here, yeah.
I've got a question about, the model, the equation model, and if you're familiar with like the work of Ken Wilber and like the integral model,
This
seems to be emotional and kind of upper left, and I was wondering if you'd given any thought to like social systems and biological systems too, and how to incorporate the equations into those other quadrants.
So that's a big, big question, which I'm going to suggest that you come up here afterwards and we talk up here, only because I'd like to answer that in a little more depth than in 2 minutes, if that's okay. That's cool. So thank you very much for sticking to the end. And for those, I hope that we got some comic books out there for you. And I wish you a great South by Southwest.